What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. We are so excited to be joined by you today. We have really an all-star panel. I'm not just saying that. It is the consensus from the people who have been commenting on this lineup. It is an all-star lineup. We even have someone making their Katie Halper Show debut. So things are really going to change quite radically for this person, obviously. Before we start, I, of course, as always, want to encourage everyone to like the stream. You do that just by giving it a thumbs up. Also, please subscribe. We're almost at 300,000 subscribers, which is amazing. So we're almost there. So help us break that 300,000 number by hitting subscribe and then the bell. And that way you won't miss any great streams with the excellent guests like we are having on today. Also, if you can, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And you'll get bonus interviews and extended interviews. And you also just get to support this show because, not to sound corny, but we really literally could not do the show without you and your support. We just wouldn't be able to do it. So we are so grateful to all of you who come to the show, who like the show with a thumbs up, who subscribe, and also who are Patreon supporters. And again, at the $1 a month level, you get to make the show happen. At the $5 a month level, you get to have access to extra interviews. So I'm going to bring on our first guest. During the second half of the show, we're going to be joined by the brilliant Vijay Prashad. But we are also going to be joined, you are so in luck, because we have brilliant guests for the first half as well. And we're going to be joined by Muin Rabbani, who is a researcher, analyst, and commentator specializing in Palestinian affairs. And we're also going to be joined by, making his Katie Halper Show debut, Trita Parsi, who is the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. He is the award-winning author of Losing the Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, and Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. So welcome, Muin and Trita.
Very good to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Of course. I'm so happy to be joined by you guys. I want to start off by actually playing a video that you tweeted out, Trita. This is a great, I think, encapsulation of some of the stuff that's happening right now as we speak. There is a sidelining of Israel, perhaps, definitely more than we're used to, but that something seems to be shifting. And we have a great video that we're going to watch right now of an Israeli spokesman who can't really handle when that reality is presented to him. So let's take a look at this clip and then have you guys react to it.
It does seem that there's a pattern developing. America has done this deal without Israel. They've done a deal with the Houthis. No Israel. They're talking to Iran. No Israel. Isn't this all humiliating for Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yeah, that's, again, the story which Hamas want you to share. But this war will end when the hostages come home and Hamas are gone. Simple as that. Not a minute before.
I'm merely stating facts and asking you questions. You can't
answer
everything.
No, they're not facts. They're opinions. They're opinions. We won't rest until...
Americans have done this,
Mark. And, Mark, you've been wrong about this war in every single moment. And we've had this discussion over the last 19 months. You've been wrong at every single point. You want to capitulate. You want Israel to capitulate to Hamas, and we won't. We won't do it because we're a democracy. I'm happy to be asked questions.
I appreciate that. Completely appreciate that.
Ask me a decent question and I'll answer it.
Well, please do. Tell me where this is wrong. Did the Americans have any involvement in the release of this? The Israelis have any involvement in the release of this hostage? Have the Israelis had any involvement in the deal with the Houthis that the Americans have done? Are the Israelis talking to Iran at the moment? That's were my questions. Where am I wrong on that? Please tell me, because it'll be interesting to know.
We are closer than ever with our American allies. What you're sharing is a view which Israel's enemies would like to share it to the outside world. It's not just wrong, it's morally backwards. Let's not confuse the arsonist with the firefighter. We're fighting to defeat Hamas in this war.
Okay, so, I mean, I don't even know where to start. He was presented with some facts that are inconvenient, so he's saying that they're Hamas talking points. I mean, Trita, you want to jump in because you tweeted this out, and then I'd love to get your response to this, Muin, as well.
I think what you're seeing here is the Israelis being in a state of shock, expecting that Trump would not only be a continuation of Biden that essentially lifted all restrictions on Israel and allowed Israel to do whatever it wanted, but actually would go further. And in some aspects, Trump proved to be that in the sense that he accelerated a blueprint that already existed in terms of ethnic cleansing in Gaza and turning it into some sort of, or depopulating it and turning it into something else. Incidentally, the Biden administration did task the USAID to do a feasibility study already in November 2023 to see how it could remove all Palestinians from Gaza and put them in the Sinai. So much of what we have seen is actually a continuation of what already existed before. But instead now they're encountering that when Trump decides that something is important for him, then he is willing to break with anyone, including, of course, Israel, which is unusual in the American political context and shocking to the Israelis. And what has happened is that it's been happening at a fast pace on several different fronts at the same time. You had a deal with the Houthis that the Israelis did not even know about. You had a separate negotiation to release the American-Israeli hostage in Gaza, and even sending signals of potentially recognizing Palestine, being open to a deal with Hamas that actually would leave them in Gaza, but they would have to disarm. And then, of course, the talks with Iran, which also came as a shock to the Israelis, because it wasn't until Netanyahu was in the Oval Office in front of the cameras in which Trump revealed that actually 5 days later they wouldn't meet face-to-face with the Iranians. So it's been very fast, very shocking, and I think it makes it very difficult for the Israelis to push back, because it was one thing if they were only fighting over the Iran variable. But now Trump has turned the tables on them and is moving in different directions on all issues, including just taking a look at this trip. He's going to all of these countries. He's not mentioning Israel once. He's not stopping by Israel. And then on top of that, he's now also going to Turkey. And as you know, the Israelis have a big problem with Erdogan right now because of Syria. And then he's lifting sanctions on Syria, which the Israelis also were against. The only thing that could be worse now is if he adds a stop in Tehran, then I think heads would explode in Israel. But short of that, this has been a massive humiliation for the Israelis.
Yeah. Thank God for that. But I have to say, it's somewhat entertaining to watch that last clip. So thank God for small favors like that. Muin, what do you have to add to that analysis?
Yeah, it's a total meltdown. And, you know, what does Mercer, I'm not quite sure what his name is, his response is basically to claim, well, relations are better than ever. You know, don't believe your lion eyes. I think Israel's problem is twofold. First of all, it's a different Middle East than it was during the first Trump administration. During the first Trump administration, the United States, Israel and the Arab monarchies were very closely aligned on a regional agenda to destroy the Iranian nuclear agreement, to weaken Iran, to marginalize the Palestinians, to normalize relations between Israel and Arab states. That's not the case anymore. The Arab states saw how the United States was either unwilling or incapable of protecting them from Iranian attacks, most notably the sophisticated drone and missile attack on the Aramco facilities in 2018 or 2019. They have normalized their relations with Iran and are now encouraging the United States to make a deal with Iran. And rather than seeing Israel as a valuable security partner, they're seeing it as the regional arsonist. And then the United States has changed as well. You know, when Israel is dealing with the Democratic Party, which more or less operates like a normal political party, well, then you can buy politicians, you can primary those who don't get with the program, and so on. But the Republican Party is a personality cult. And regardless of the instincts of its officials and politicians, they're more scared of Trump than they are of Israel and its lobby. And that's proving to be a real, real problem for Israel. And I think particularly the recent revelations that the now former National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, was scheming behind Trump's back with Netanyahu to seek to foment a war, a U.S. war with Iran on Israel's behalf. I think that was very badly received in the White House. Is there a crisis in U.S.-Israeli relations? I'm not sure we're at that point. Excuse me. But clearly, you know, it's no longer the Biden years where it's total unconditional support for anything and everything Israel. Those days are over, and you know, as the interviewer said, the Washington is now cutting deals with Iran, with the Houthis, even with Hamas, either behind Israel's back or riding roughshod over Israel, or simply ignoring Israel's own priorities. And, you know, the idea now that you have, an administration in Washington that not only prioritizes U.S. national security interests, but is happy to do so even at the expense of Israeli interests, has come as a real shock to the Israelis. And they can't adjust. And the response is just to have a total meltdown.
Could I add one thing, Katie? I completely agree with Moeen on this issue, that there is that political element in the sense that I think Moeen put it very well. They're more afraid of challenging Trump than they're afraid of the various lobbies that are closely aligned with Israel. There is another factor, however, which is that you have a very different political evolution taking place on the American right, on the American MAGA right, in which some of these old slogans have actually built out into more of an intellectual framework for how they view the world and foreign policy. And this is an element that is strictly against further military engagements around the world, who believes, rightly or wrongly, that a lot of these wars are wars as a result of either the foreign policy establishment loving war, or because of America's alliance system, in which various countries are pushing the United States into unnecessary and endless wars. And for a long time, a lot of the conservatives could hold that view while making an exception for Israel. But it's reached a point in which that cognitive dissonance no longer can function, because if you make an exception for Israel, you have negated the entire principle, because it is the country, at least at this moment, that is most active in trying to drag the United States into another war in the Middle East. And that has now changed the situation. So now you have the Tucker Carlsons, the Charlie Kirks You have Marjorie Taylor Greene coming out and saying things that we're so against war. My constituents or the American heartland, they're not facing these problems. They're facing completely different problems. And even if it is Israel, we are against this. That is a new political reality. I think 10, 15 years ago, people would not have expected that some of the strongest anti-war elements, as well as willing to call out Israel elements in the U.S., would be found on the American right.
And why is that? What is this? I mean, this America first, this, you know, there's that term that gets thrown around a lot, isolationism, but let's use the term America first. What makes this possible now as opposed to 10 or 15 years ago when that ideology was still out there or was already out there, I should say?
Well, I think one of the critical elements here is the fatigue that exists in the country as a whole, on the left and the right, against further military engagements and war. And I think it may be stronger on the right for a very simple reason. Where does the American military recruit its soldiers? Where do those soldiers come from that get killed, or the soldiers that come back to a country that is not necessarily ready to really reintegrate them in society in the manner that they should be? You have more of that on the right because they're from more poorer districts, etc. So you have a more natural, perhaps, tendency there to be really skeptical about the establishment who lie them into all of these different wars, about all of these different entanglements. And then on the right, you ended up having someone who was willing to channel that sentiment in Trump. Whereas on the left, it did exist, but it was so dramatically and fiercely slammed down by the Democratic establishment. And I'm talking about how Bernie Sanders ran against Hillary Clinton in 2016. So that type of a channeling has not happened in the same way on the left, but it has ended up becoming the winning card on the right.
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's I think worth noting that none of this means that Trump cares about Palestinians. It means that he's open to different political pressures. And something that I said, you know, before the election was that I could see things being just as bad under Trump. I could see things being worse under Trump. I could see things being maybe better under Trump. I'm just talking about with the Middle East. And the only reason I thought that there was the possibility of that being better, and that's a very low bar because better means what? Just like not an unfolding genocide, but was because he's not an ideologue. He's not a committed Zionist the way that Biden is. He really is an opportunist. And I kept fantasizing that Netanyahu would do something that would make him feel slighted personally, like that would make Trump feel slighted, and that would cause Trump to shift policy. And hopefully, you know, all those coincidences or all those factors that both of you have brought up, maybe combining with what happened with Waltz is a good combination. We can certainly hope. So I wanted to also ask you guys about if you could respond to the surprising, perhaps, shift that we're seeing vis-a-vis Ansar Allah, you know, who people call the Houthis. And here we have Trump talking about the Ansar Allah in an interesting way. I wanted to know what you guys had to say about this.
Very good outcome with the Houthis. And we honor their word. I mean, they made a commitment. And we dealt with other countries that were close to them and their surrogates. And we honor all of their words. We'll see what happens. But I think, you know, I believe that hopefully that's over with. And they'll leave the ships alone, you know, just leave those ships alone. But so we do. We take their word for it. It was, you know, we hit them very hard. They had a great capacity to withstand punishment. They took tremendous punishment. And, you know, you could say there's a lot of bravery there. It was amazing what they took. But we honor their commitment and their word. They gave us their word that they wouldn't be shooting ships anymore, and we honor that.
So what are your thoughts on this praise of the Houthis?
I mean, I think it's important to understand what happened is that the United States under Biden basically started launching attacks on Yemen in order to make the Gaza Strip safe for Israeli genocide. Trump came into office and very significantly ramped up this campaign. But it failed to achieve any of its objectives, as Trump indicated in the clip you just showed. And there was a recent analysis in the New York Times that showed just how much of a failure this campaign has been when measured against U.S. objectives, and that the Houthis apparently came quite close to downing an F-35 and so on. And Trump basically decided to call it quits. The military failed to achieve its objectives, and he decided to call it quits and reached a deal with Ansar Allah, with the Houthis. And here's the extraordinary part. It was a bilateral ceasefire. In other words, a commitment between the United States and Ansar Allah to stop attacking each other and leaving the Houthis completely free to continue firing missiles and drones at Israel until Israel ends its genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And this is a really extraordinary part because, it responds also to the point you raised before you showed this clip. And we've seen it also, in these other agreements that the Trump administration has been making in the Middle East. During Trump's first term, pandering to Israel was the opportunistic thing to do. It worked and it paid dividends. During the second Trump administration, it's turning out to be quite the opposite. Yes, you're right. Trump couldn't care a hoot for the Palestinians. The difference is he doesn't care for Israel either. He doesn't care for anybody. And he's prepared to go along with Israel's agenda if it serves him. And during the first term, that seemed to be the case. But now, not going along with Israel and even resisting some of its initiatives is being seen as the opportunistic thing to do that serves his interests best.
If I could add to that, I agree, and I would perhaps take it one step further. He's also not against Israel. This is not him actually trying to be anti-Israeli. That's
he doesn't
not
care
what
one
I
or
think.
The other.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He's indifferent. He'll go along with them if he feels that that is in their in his interest. Right now, he's not in favor of some of the things that the Israelis want. That may also change if he concludes that that is in his interest. So this is not, strongly standing on anti-war principles or anything like that. I think there are anti-war pressures that he's going to take very seriously because his base had really consolidated around some of those ideas. And in the case of the Houthis, I have to say, I think it was a huge mistake what Trump did in going in the first place. But given the outcome, and there's more details that probably will come out, and when he's saying, for instance, that they're really tough, the Pentagon threw all kinds of things to destroy some of the places where they held their missiles, for instance, but not the ones that would actually penetrate into those caves or whatever they are. But within 6 hours, the Houthis have dug it up and they continue to fire back. And there were several very dangerous incidents. And unlike other presidents, instead of feeling like, well, I started this, even though it doesn't work, even though it doesn't have any prospects of success, it would be embarrassing for me to back off. Instead, he did. He backed off, declared victory, because he recognized what a losing proposition it was for him having gone down this path. And incidentally, the Yemen element was an important factor in the firing of Waltz as well. It wasn't just some of the other things that had been done. And in that sense, he shows a nimbleness and flexibility that we rarely see with other presidents who are constantly worried that they will come across as weak. I'm not saying that Trump doesn't have that, but he has an ability to pull back when he thinks it's in his interest and declare victory, even though when you scratch the surface, it's very clear that the picture is much, much more nuanced than that.
If I could just add one point, I mean, just to give an impression of the changed landscape. If you go back a decade, if you remember, one of the key criticisms of Obama wasn't that Obama was anti-Israel. It wasn't that Obama was indifferent to Israel. The criticism was Obama doesn't love Israel. I mean, that was considered a legitimate criticism of a U.S. president that he
was. Remember that he didn't go to Israel on his first trip to the Middle East, and that was a big scandal as well.
I mean, imagine considering it a legitimate criticism of a head of state that he doesn't love foreign entity. It's, you know, imagine now anyone daring to criticize Trump for not being in love with Israel. That would end their political career rather than help them win the next election.
Although Dan Goldman, I don't have that tweet on him, but Dan Goldman was accusing Trump of abandoning Israel. And he was saying, you know, stop gaslighting us. We can see that you've already abandoned Israel. And but it was so funny. Like he was saying that, you know, he obviously fired Waltz because he was too much of a hawk in Iran. But he was saying these things, Dan Goldman, this Democrat congressman, major Israel supporter. He was saying these things as if they were bad, like as if it was good to be an Iran hawk, because, of course, this guy is an Iran hawk.
I mean, we do have that challenge right now that some elements in the Democratic Party, instead of actually having a foreign policy, are just having a reactionary thing against Trump on all levels. Well, and in many of those cases. Sorry?
Senator Slob Fetterman, perfect example.
And in all the cases, you know, they may be right, but it's become a knee-jerk reaction. You had Hakeem Jeffries today making a fuss about the plane, et cetera. And there's legitimate criticism that you can be putting forward, but he's like, you know, he got it from an ally of Hamas and Iran. Well, it was actually Joe Biden that elevated Qatar to the highest non-NATO level alliance. Between the U.S. and Qatar. So, I mean, it's just silly season. And the Democrats should actually take an opportunity to take a step back, formulate a proactive, positive vision for America that actually makes sense for the American people, instead of thinking, oh, foreign policy doesn't win you elections. And as a result, let's just leave that aside. Well, foreign policy loses elections. And I think this last election was very much lost because of the foreign policy of Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, I would be absolutely thrilled, and we're going to play this Hakeem Jeffries clip in a second, but I would be thrilled if, I don't care what it takes, if it took a Palace in the Sky airplane from Qatar to have more daylight between Trump and Netanyahu, I don't care. I mean, this guy's corrupt. He's going to be corrupt no matter what. So I'd like him to use his corruption for good as opposed to for bad. And that doesn't make Trump good. I'm just saying that within this incredibly corrupt opportunist, I'd like some good to come from that. Let's take a look, though, at this clip of Hakeem Jeffries.
Millions of people in this country are struggling to live paycheck to paycheck. Can't afford housing, can't afford groceries, can't afford to pay their utility bills, can't afford child care, can't afford insurance. And Donald Trump is publicly defending accepting a $400 million flying palace from a close ally of Iran and Hamas? I mean, you can't make this stuff up, which is why even some of his closest MAGA sycophants have made clear this is a plane too far for them. Too far for them.
And that, of course, is a reference to the, Palace in the Sky. And by the way, this is a guy, Hakeem Jeffries, who chanted Israel today, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever, channeling, you know, the segregationists, Wallace, but applying it. I mean, to be fair to Jeffries, that's a good callback, given what an apartheid state Israel is. So maybe he's right to being to invoke the segregationists. But yeah, what is your guys' response to that? And then I have something else I'd like to show in response to that. Yeah.
Well, I think the problem for these Israel shills is that, of course, U.S. politicians are for sale. You know, in every election cycle, they're purchased by the highest bidder. And that's certainly true of presidential candidates as well. And they had assumed, you know, that the $100 million plus that Miriam Adelson gave to Trump's election campaign ensured that they owned him. The problem is, what they didn't realize, that there was also a second auction after the election, and the Gulf states managed to mobilize more resources than Adelson and AIPAC could muster. So you know, Trump has effectively auctioned off U.S. foreign policy. And the highest bidder won it fair and square at the auction. That's the problem for Israel here.
Right. I want to show a tweet, though, in response to people like Hakeem Jeffries or also Chuck Schumer, who are up in arms about the influence of Qatar. This is a tweet from Sam Husseini, who's been a guest on the show. And he tweets, "I hate it when Qatar tries to buy off our politicians." And then, of course, shows a huge kind of jumbotron setup of an APAC conference where we see all these Israeli flags and American flags. But I mean, that's just why this is so hollow to hear these condemnations. Again, it's not that Trump isn't selling himself to the highest bidder, like you just said, Muin, right? It's not that Trump isn't totally, you know, narcissistic, but let's not pretend that the other people who are elected officials have any principles. They just hide their opportunism more. And sometimes their opportunism is kind of checked into place by their ideology. And when your ideology is Zionism, that's not really any better.
It's the proverbial drunken sailor slurring his way through a speech against alcohol abuse. You know, right. I mean, it's, you know, the hypocrisy is just overwhelming. All of a sudden, you know, these people who have made a career out of promoting a foreign state's interests are all up in arms that a different foreign state is trying to purchase influence in the U.S.
But one thing I think we should recognize, though, is that whatever the Qataris are doing or not doing is in no way, shape, or form on par with decades of organizing and other things that have taken place on the pro-Israeli side of organizing in the U.S. But also, I think we should recognize, look, this campaign against Qatar, this latest round of it, really started after the Qataris were negotiating and calling out what the Israelis were doing in Gaza. And then it dramatically intensified when they saw that Trump was going to rely not just on Qatar and Gaza, but in many other places, including on Iran. We've seen massive attacks in the campaign from the Israeli side, starting off on one of the Israeli TV channels that is essentially a mouthpiece of Netanyahu against Witkoff as well. So, and then we saw the beginning of a campaign against Oman. I mean, this is a campaign against actors, states that are actually trying to see if there's a way to find a compromise, end these wars and these conflicts. And those who have a sense that that is a threat to their interests are launching these campaigns. So I would be very careful. I know no one here tried to necessarily make that equation saying that, you know, Israel is on par with Qatar and when it comes to these things. But this is really not about them buying influence. This is about them actually trying to resolve some problems and mediate some conflict that the Israelis are very upset about.
Yeah. Well, we actually have, Brad, is that tweet that I asked about ready? The Dan Goldman one? So this is hilarious. So this is a response to Ambassador Mike Huckabee. So Mike Huckabee tweeted out, "It is reckless and irresponsible to for the press to allege that POTUS and Israeli PM are not getting along. Bibi has spent more time with Donald Trump than I have in the past 3 months, and I'm his ambassador. The relationship between U.S. and Israel remains strong." And then Daniel Goldman, Democrat, tweets in response to that, "The Trump administration can try to gaslight us with hollow words, but actions speak louder. One, fired Waltz partly because he was too hawkish on Iran. Two, entered into a deal with the Houthis that excludes Israel. Three, pursuing Saudi deal without Israeli normalization. Trump is abandoning Israel." I mean, don't get my hopes up.
If only,
yeah, right. But
I mean, it's really interesting. During the summer of 2015, when Obama was fighting for the JCPOA in Congress, you had a major shift in Congress amongst the Democrats. And when Netanyahu was so blatantly going up against an American president, attacking it, coordinating with the Republicans at the time to give that speech in Congress, it became really problematic for many of the Democrats to take such blatantly pro-Israel positions with no regard whatsoever for American interests. And now we're in this completely different space. And I think that this worries me, because I think in order to actually get a true correction to U.S. policy in the Middle East, and we need to have a completely rebalancing with many states, including with Israel, it can't just be driven by one party. it needs to be anchored in both parties. And it's a problem if Trump going in this direction then elevates the voices in the Democratic Party who wants to go back to the type of a Biden complete deference to Israel, completely imbalanced relationship. Ultimately, that's going to serve the U.S. very badly, and it's going to be very bad for the region as well.
Right. Shifting gears, but it's obviously related. Can you talk about the latest in Iran? And Trita, you actually have a piece that you just wrote for, well, I don't want to say where you wrote it for, because I don't want people to hold it against you, my viewers, but you did write it for the American Conservative, and this is okay. It's a safe space. And I actually think it's important. I mean, I went on a show today of someone who I really, someone named Daniel Davis, who's a lieutenant colonel who was going to be named by Trump to some position. And then because he had said things that were critical of Israel, he got, you know, thrown to the wayside. But I think it's, you know, I was happy to go on his show, and I think it's fascinating. He's evangelical, he's born again, and we do not see eye to eye on many things, but we definitely do see eye to eye on like Palestinians being human beings. I mean, that's a terribly low bar, but again, it is politics makes for strange bedfellows. So can you tell us the main thesis of your piece that you just wrote?
Let me also first start saying something about this. I think it's actually crucial to be able to talk to both sides, because there is such a tremendous agreement on a lot of foreign policy issues between the left and the right. It's just not within the center, within the foreign policy establishment. That's where the real disagreements are. And for the Quincy Institute, it's easy because we only deal with foreign policy, so we can compartmentalize domestic and foreign policy. I know for other individuals, obviously, it may be more challenging, but ultimately, if you want to get a change, you need to be able to talk to both sides and discover that there is actually a tremendous amount of commonality on both sides. So I publish in The Nation, I publish in The American Conservative. And I think, frankly, that's the way we need to operate in order to be able to bring about sustainable change. What I write about in The American Conservative today is that the last round of talks, I think there was some backstepping taking place. The zero enrichment fantasy resurfaced in a way that I think is very problematic, because this is an objective that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Pompeo and Nikki Haley and Bolton were pushing. And it's just a fantasy that is also very counterproductive. The more time we spend on trying to get the Iranians to completely capitulate, all we're actually doing is to give them more time to expand their program and delay the reasonable and realistic restrictions that a verification deal would impose on them. But in this specific scenario, it's even more problematic, because you have a deadline of what is called snapback sanctions that expires later this fall. And the Europeans are very likely to trigger it and reimpose a bunch of UN sanctions on Iran if there isn't some sort of an agreement. And that is a hard deadline that cannot just be pushed forward easily. And as a result, if we are wasting time now on fantasies that never have worked, that are counterproductive, the very crucial window that exists to be able to strike a deal that evades war, evades an Iranian nuclear weapon, may very well be gone. And then Trump is going to be on a very negative trajectory. And many of these other things that he's been trying to do, some of them I would say are actually quite positive, will be out the window. So it's crucial to make sure that this gets right. And if any resurgence or resurfacing of the zero enrichment fantasy, I think would be a huge mistake.
Hmm. Right. You also, Muin, do you want to say anything in response to that?
I completely agree. And I think many people don't realize that this is not just about the U.S. and Iran negotiating until they either do or don't reach an agreement. But there is this October deadline, which, as Trita explained, if the Europeans then do the snapback sanctions, then Iran is most likely to leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and throw out the IAEA inspectors. And then there's essentially very little left to negotiate. And I think, you know, the hawks in the administration recognize this. And it's for that reason that they're constantly pushing these ideas, which they know will never produce an agreement, but at least they succeed in wasting time and narrowing the remaining window for an agreement to be consummated.
Right. We also have a, I think, relevant poll that you tweeted out, Trita, about U.S. American support for war with Iran versus diplomacy. So let's take a look at that. It's right here. So you tweeted this out. American policy aims to limit the likelihood of Iran developing nuclear weapons. Which path do you prefer the administration pursue to achieve that end? And what you have here is you had kind of a meta-analysis.
Yeah, so 69% of all Americans favor diplomatic solution, and only 14, if I remember correctly, favor a military approach to this. Which, I mean, if you're sitting in Washington, these are shocking numbers, because the decibel of the voices arguing for military strikes or arguing for the pathways that will lead to military strikes are very, very strong. But when you look outside in the country, it has no base at all. I mean, FDD, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is a bizarre name for that organization, seems to have no constituency in the United States at all, except for a handful of people in Washington, D.C. itself.
Right. I also wanted to show a tweet that you, Trita, commented on. It's of the wonderful Emily Schrader, who is, I guess, an Israeli spokesperson. She's from the United States. She dates this sociopath. I can't remember his name. You know, he's one of the guys who was in one of the Oxford debates. But because the irony is that they're both like shills for Israel. But I think because he's not Jewish, they can't get legally married in Israel. So they're just like boyfriend and girlfriend. But here's what she had to say about Steve Witkoff. She called Steve Witkoff, who is Trump's negotiator, the mullah's favorite negotiator, Steve Witkoff, quote, "We're going to take them at their word. They don't want a nuclear weapon. I don't think they, the Islamic Republic, as she calls them, are going to be able to manipulate me." And then Emily goes, "I'm speechless at the never-ending naivete of Steve Witkoff. This man is dangerously ignorant when it comes to negotiating with terrorist dictatorships." So what are your guys' response to that?
Well, I mean, this is what I was referring to earlier on. There has been an ongoing campaign by elements within the Israeli government to go after Witkoff, to go after Qatar, Oman, etc. And, you know, calling Witkoff the mullah's favorite negotiator. I mean, it says quite a lot. And I think this is really an act of desperation and quite unwise by some of these folks, because they're going to go up against an element that otherwise may not have ended up being so negative towards them within the MAGA crowd. And Witkoff right now, is his stocks are extremely high in Trump circles. To go after him, it's really, really stupid. But I think it tells you how desperate they are and how disoriented they are to think that this would work. Just because it would really have worked if Biden was president, it doesn't work today. It's going to be counterproductive for them.
Right. And by the way, I meant to mention that was a University of Maryland poll that you had showed. And I also want Joseph Haddad is the name of her awful boyfriend. But, you know, something, another funny thing about the kind of attack on Witkoff. And then we're going to actually get into what Israel is doing to Palestinians. We don't have, because we haven't focused on that. We've been focusing more on kind of the diplomacy, but we should make sure that we acknowledge some of Israel's recent most, I mean, it's like you think it can't get any worse, and then somehow they manage to be even worse and worse. But I just want to show a video that an Israeli journalist, Mariav Zonzain, she tweeted this out, and it says, "Witkoff has been to Hostage Square in Tel Aviv 2 times. Netanyahu has never stepped foot there." Now, of course, this is also like gives us a chance to see a really cute dog. But I just think it's just ironic that these people, you know, their whole shtick, right, is that they care about Jewish lives. They care about Jews. They care about Israelis. Like, you know, I think it's been helpful in some ways just to see how. For some people, I mean, it doesn't matter how they treat Palestinians, unfortunately. But I think that something that is very kind of revealing is that they don't even care about Jews, Israeli Jews, American Jews. You know, they have a political project, and they're not going to let the lives of hostages get in the way of that project.
Well, buyer's remorse. I mean, Israel and its lobby did everything within their power to help ensure that Trump won the election and that Kamala Harris lost it. And, you know, now he's in office and he's doing things that neither Biden nor Harris would have considered in a million years. And as we discussed earlier, they're having a complete meltdown and desperately lashing out in increasingly hysterical terms against people like Steve Witkoff, who, as Trita noted, is very close to Trump. He's not just a political ally. He's a very close personal ally. And, you know, when you start attacking him in the way that Israel's flunkies have been, you know, and you get these kind of programmed concertos by the Hasbara Symphony Orchestra, where it's very obvious, you know, that this is being done in a coordinated way, the White House is going to notice. And for a president as thin-skinned as Trump is, and who's, you know, so particularly attuned to personal slights and insults, it's an open question about how well it's going to end for them. And also, you know, with Witkoff, I mean, given kind of the redefinition of Jew hatred, Witkoff and the U.S. hostage envoy Adam Buller have kind of been elevated to the rank of chief anti-Semites. It's just too much for words.
Right. Right. Yeah, it is really stunning. I'm going to do two really quick kind of lighthearted things. And then we're going to get, sadly, we're going to then turn to things that we have to cover because the rest of the media, so much of the media doesn't. But I wanted to do, I was actually inspired by you, Muin. You made fun of Eyal Yacobi. You called him, I think you said he was lobotomized.
No, Eyal Lobotomy.
Eyal Lobotomy, right. Eyal Lobotomy, right.
We really have to waste time on this.
Well, I just want to show one thing. So let's take, I often struggle to figure out if someone is dumb or disingenuous. So I thought we could start a dumb or disingenuous of the week. So let's see. I tweeted it out. Your dumb or disingenuous of the week, Eyal Yacobi. Is he a liar, an idiot, or 50-50? Vote below. And this was the tweet from Eyal. It was, why is a Newark airport employee wearing the symbol of a group that literally invented plane hijackings? How did that not raise a single flag? And let's see what the results of this poll are. But of course, as many people have pointed out, that's just false information.
I think the first one was in Peru, and there were over 100 hijackings before the first Palestinian hijacking in the late 1960s.
Muin, should we vote liar, idiot, or 50-50?
100-100.
All right.
If I could just say, I mean, I'd seen this guy around, and the first time I paid attention to him, he had this debate with Mark Lamont Hill. Mm. And at one point, he started making the argument that the Palestinians didn't even consider Palestine to be an entity or something along those lines, because the 1964 Palestinian National Charter defined the West Bank as part of Jordan. And with a completely straight face, he started explaining, you know, Article 2 of the 1964 Charter, and he started quoting it. And then I went, you know, I knew it couldn't be true, but, you know, you always have a little doubt. So I looked it up. He just made it up out of thin air. I mean, the guy lies with absolute and total fluency. You know, he couldn't even, you know, you can't even trust him to tell you the time. It's just incredible. I mean, even by the standards of these Israel flunkies, the amount of distortion and falsehood and fraud. The guy's only 23, you know, but he produces a veritable tsunami of BS on an almost hourly basis. I mean, it's not someone who provides arguments that you disagree with. It's just an avalanche of total falsehoods, things invented out of thin air, and he does it very fluently. You know, his parents must have started training him at a very, very young age.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible. It's stunning. I mean, this is mostly cathartic because I can't stand watching his lies. So while I kind of don't want to elevate him, I mean, he's already met Trump. He's elevated enough. He's he talks about anti-Semitism, and here are the results. So the consensus is that it is he is 50-50. 60.9% think he's a half liar, half idiot, followed by people think he's a liar. And then the other ones think he's an idiot. So that's been our first poll.
Hitty, I'm so sorry. I have to run, right?
Okay.
You promised that this would be a life-changing experience. It was. You were absolutely right. So okay, it was a great pleasure to be with both of you. I look forward
Thank you
so much. Have a good evening.
Okay. You too. Muin, do you have like 5 more minutes?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay, great. How about actually, Vijay, do you want to come and join? Hop on with Muin? Should we do that? Let's do that because I want to show both of you. This will be okay. Hi, Muin. Hi, Vijay.
Hi,
welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Because we're running behind, but I just realized that you actually would be perfect person to join and also contribute to this conversation. People know and love Vijay. He is a journalist. He is an historian. He is the author of several books, including books with the inimitable Noam Chomsky. He also is the editor of Leftward Books. Is that the Leftward Books, right?
That's right.
And he's at Tricontinental and Globetrotter, both of which are amazing entities. So welcome, Vijay.
Nice to see you both. Yeah. Both in the big bad up there.
Yes, I know.
It's really interesting because I was listening to you and I don't know any of these people that you were talking about.
You're lucky.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you're so lucky.
I have no idea who these people are. It's
keep it that
extraordinary.
Way.
I mean, yeah. You know, I obviously follow Trump and so on, but the minions are not in my radar.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Sorry. I feel like I'm going to have to pay for your therapy now.
No, it's, but, it's what I suppose would be interesting is a map or something,
right.
You know, or maybe I just don't bother. That's the other side of it.
Yeah, well, no, it's nice because you're covering people who are actually doing good things in the world. So, and we'll get to that shortly. But, you know, I did want to mention that Eyal Lobotomy is one of the people who claims that American Jews are facing an all-time high of anti-Semitism. And so people may have also seen that the Free Press, which Vijay, you may be blessed not knowing about them, that's Barry Weiss's outlet. So it's a fake anti-cancel culture, anti-woke culture outlet that actually, as people know, Barry Weiss leads the charges to have people canceled all the time. She tried to get Professor Joseph Mossad fired of Columbia.
The free speech absolutist who's absolutely against free speech.
Yeah. Right. I guess she's consistent in that way. Yeah. There is some absolute there. So she had a journalist, someone named Maya, do a report on the scathing, indicting Harvard report that just came out about anti-Semitism. So a friend of the show, this is a Katie Halper Show co-production, made a little bit of an edit where we fill in some of the missing information or offer some analysis of this video about anti-Semitism. So let us take a look. Free Press reporter debunks Harvard anti-Semitism report in 3 minutes. Obviously, that's not her intention. Okay.
I'm Maya. I'm a reporter for the Free Press, and I just went through Harvard's anti-Semitism report, and here are some of the most disturbing things that I found. Nearly 60% of Jewish students at Harvard said they'd experienced discrimination, stereotyping, or negative bias on campus due to their views on current events.
Being judged for your views on current events isn't anti-Semitism.
Jewish students also said that they concealed their identity from classmates.
No one made them do that.
And I've been ghosted by longtime friends for expressing sympathy for Israel or for simply appearing on an Instagram post with someone who did.
In other words, their longtime friends had no problem at all with them being Jewish and only ghosted them when they turned out to be Zionists. That's not anti-Semitism, obviously.
At Harvard Medical School's Admitted Students Day, one student was told by another that Zionists are not welcome at Harvard Medical School.
Zionism isn't Judaism, it's racism. It is not anti-Semitic to call someone out for being a racist. It is anti-Semitic to equate Zionism with Judaism, like Maya is doing here.
At Harvard Divinity School, an Israeli doctoral student said that the professor began a class about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by telling students that the discourse is saturated with the Israeli narrative.
It is the Palestinian narrative gets almost no play in American media. Of the three MSNBC hosts who expressed sympathy for Palestinians, one has been fired and two had their shows canceled.
And that she had decided to, with a heavy heart, remove Israeli sources from the syllabus.
Good.
During listening sessions with the Anti-Semitism Task Force, Jewish students spoke about Harvard-run privilege trainings, where they were told that they were deemed to be privileged not only by dint of being identified as white, but also because of their Jewishness, which allegedly endowed them with an even higher level of privilege.
On average, Jewish Americans have the highest percentage of households earning $100,000 or more.
Students reported that when they voiced concerns about bias, they were asked, who is more marginalized, Jews or Palestinians?
Palestinians.
In response to a friend who knew people who were killed at the Nova Music Festival, one student reported a close friend said, I mean, I guess that sucks, but what did they expect?
It was an insensitive comment, but the question of why anyone would go to a music festival so close to occupied land is not unreasonable, nor is it anti-Semitic.
Another person asked, do you believe in decolonization in theory or in practice?
What does that have to do with Judaism? Good question.
An Israeli graduate student reported that one of his friends was told that it would hurt his career to associate with a Zionist and to be publicly associated with one.
That is not even a little bit true. No one's career has been hurt by associating with Zionists. There are, however, countless examples of people's careers and even lives being destroyed for standing in opposition to Zionism.
These are just some of the findings of the report based on 50 listening sessions with a total of about 500 students, faculty, and staff, as well as over 2,000 respondents to an online survey, including 477 students who identified themselves as Jewish.
In summary, she read the entire report on anti-Semitism at Harvard and couldn't find one example.
You can read my full report at thefp.com.
You can. But it's just more of this bullshit. Yeah. So that's the report on the report. But I mean, I was actually surprised that they couldn't dig up more lies or more inflammatory examples of rando saying something, which is what they often do to pretend that there's a systemic problem. But that's really scraping the bottom of the barrel. I didn't hear anything anti-Semitic there.
It's a DEI on steroids.
Right. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. But, you know, it's so disgusting. But I bring it up because I think it's so important to remind people what we're not talking about when we talk about this. So just to summarize some of the recent things that have happened, I mean, it's so disturbing, but, you know, people get, I think, used to the images of genocide, desensitized, let's say, but I think it's really important to remind people or update people because it's so never ending and nonstop. So last night, the Gazan photojournalist Hassan Eslaith, who provided widely circulated photographs of the October 7th attack, was killed by Israel while recuperating in Nasser Hospital from burns he sustained in a previous attack. Okay, he was killed along with one other person, and that makes Elsa the 178th journalist killed since the genocide began. Israel also bombed a European hospital in Khan Yunis today multiple times, killing at least 28 people. This is, I mean, unbelievable. Over the weekend, an Israeli gunboat murdered the 12-year-old Mohammed al-Bardawi on Rafah Beach. He was one of the eyewitnesses to the massacre of the 15 rescue workers, paramedics, who were executed by Israel. He recounted what he saw to the New York Times. And so he was killed, and he's 12 years old. And in the West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and beat a young man, Mohammed al-Kasba, who was entering the Kalandia refugee camp. This is something that, you know, would be front page news. If any of these things that we just recounted happened to Israelis, it would be front page news. And then you have Netanyahu saying some really scary stuff about the, you know, obviously in seeming defiance of the opening of channels between the U.S. and Hamas. So he said, quote, we in the coming days will be entering with all our strength to complete the process to subdue Hamas. It could be that Hamas will say, pause, we want to release another 10 hostages. OK, release them. We will receive them. And after that, enter. But there will not be a situation where we stop the war. He also suggested forcing out 50% of the population. And he will not, even though Hamas has agreed to cede power in the Gaza Strip, they won't totally dismantle, totally disarm. And Netanyahu is saying that unless that happens, they won't stop.
I mean, if I may say something about this, one interesting thing that I don't know how it's been reported in other places, but one interesting feature is on the 27th of January, the Palestinians effectively annulled the effects of the genocide by, in a very organized fashion, marching northward from wherever they had been displaced to, back to northern Gaza, back to Gaza City, back to the various camps around Gaza City, back to the small towns north of Khan Yunis, and so on. That was actually a defeat for Israel, because whatever gains Israel might have thought it had made, and the United States as well, saying, you know, we're going to build a Riviera, Trump talking about, you know, building, I guess, the Trump Hotel or whatever. The fact that, you know, thousands of Palestinians marched in an organized fashion on that one day with drones filming them, with young Palestinian men climbing up cell towers and flying large Palestinian flags, that was a directly in-your-face sucker move to Netanyahu. And right after that, and I take that as an enormous victory for the Palestinian resistance, that act itself, you know, and I don't think we've actually emphasized how important that was. That meant that right afterwards, Netanyahu starts one of the most vicious sieges, because that's when the food gets cut. Almost right after that, they start saying, we're going to shut off this, we're going to shut off that again. And they try to, in a sense, replay the genocide, you know, in real time, in order to get people out of there once more. And people are not going to move. I mean, people are basically saying they can kill us here. When I was in Gaza in 2014, after the 2014 bombing.
Oh, sorry, one second. I'm so sorry, Vijay. I just want to, I know it's my fault. I know that Muin has to leave. So I just want to, it's totally my fault. It's my fault. I got too excited to have you on together. When you were in Gaza,
Interruption. I just want to make the point that Netanyahu can say whatever he wants, but of course, the decisions will be made for him by the Americans, because Israel, at the end of the day, is a client regime. It's a proxy state, and it will do as it's told. It's been somewhat amusing, you know, to see in recent days as part of this meltdown of Israel flunkies saying, you know, we don't need U.S. Military aid, almost as if for all these years they've been doing the United States a favor by deigning to accept several billion dollars in free weaponry and Security Council vetoes and all the rest of it. But, you know, Netanyahu has pledged that Israel will resume and intensify its genocidal onslaught on the Gaza Strip once Trump leaves the region. If it does, that means it has a green light from Washington. And if it doesn't, that means that Trump and the person who is effectively a Secretary of State, Steve Witkoff, have decided that Israel should do otherwise. So we will be learning quite quickly which way the wind is blowing.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Muin. And I'm glad that you and Vijay got to overlap a little bit. We'll have to bring you back together another time, because I think that would be a fascinating conversation.
Bye.
And Vijay, thank you again so much. Everyone is so excited to have you back. It's been so long. But you were saying when you were in Gaza.
Yeah, in 2014. I mean, what people said at that time. And by the way, honestly, I thought what I had seen there was the worst possible situation. And I've been to Iraqi cities that have been effectively leveled. I mean, people were saying at the time, Palestinians in Gaza, that this is the worst it's ever been. And then, of course, this happens. But I mean, I know the people who live in those communities, you know, they recognize two things, which I think are important. One, look, they are not silly. They know that Gaza itself, they may have been born and brought up in Gaza, but they know that their villages and towns are now in 1948 Israel. Most Palestinians who were born and brought up in Gaza don't have ancestral ties to Gaza. You know, they come from 48 Israel. They came to Gaza as Nakba refugees and Naqsa refugees and so on, 48, 67, whatever. There are some, obviously, Palestinians, you know, Gaza City is a very old city. There are, but by and large, most people come from elsewhere. So they know that they are not going to be able to return if they leave Gaza. If they go to Egypt, the return is not going to be allowed. So they don't want to leave. That's why they marched back to, you know, whatever they had to find to live in northern Gaza, in the midst of rotting bodies under rubble and so on. It's horrendous. So one is they know that if they leave, they will never be allowed to come back. The other is that this is the stubbornness of people. You know, people are stubborn. I mean, I have some friends who have left Gaza, you know, out of fear for their families and whatnot. But there are also people who are just stubborn. They are going to refuse. In Arabic, the word they use is smooth, you know, steadfastness. But in fact, the real word isn't steadfastness, it's stubbornness. People just won't leave. I have some friends who are still there. They just will not leave. And that stubbornness comes from this certainty that if they leave, they will never be able to return to Gaza. And if they leave Gaza, there is no hope for them to return back to 48 Israel. I mean, most of the people I've met in that region have an idea that at some point, Israel is going to decide to say, okay, you can come back and live next to us. You may not live in the home you had in 1948, but you can live somewhere in that area. That is what people imagine, you know. In fact, I would say I have yet to meet a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank, Gaza, and in Jerusalem, who says all the Israelis should be kicked out and we should go back and get the land. In fact, that is not how most people think. Most people think we would just like to go and live there. You know, we're not going to get into the details. We would like to live there. So I just want to say that I think what happened on January 27th is extremely significant, and it shows that the Palestinian resistance is alive and well. And this is not a story just of victims. The Palestinians are right. Not victims. You know, they are fighting as people, and that really makes my heart want to explode.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I feel like my heart is like simultaneously like exploding in a million directions, because when we see this journalist who was killed, and again, he was killed while recovering from another attack, and you see these disgusting journalists, Israeli journalists, who are saying that he's Hamas, he's embedded, he's not a journalist, he's Hamas. Meanwhile, you have literal Israeli journalists who are embedded in the IDF, which commits more terrorism than anyone else could even dream of committing. I mean, even if they had all day, they wouldn't be able to commit the amount of terrorism and collective punishment. So like the absolute nerve of these Israeli journalists who are accusing someone else of being a terrorist, not being a real journalist, it is just so shameful. And we know that they target journalists. It's disgusting because they're truth tellers. And then to see this child who's, I read reports that he's 12. We know that he's young, and you can see he's young. So this is Mohammed al-Bardawi, a young witness to the March 23rd attack on medics in Gaza, who was killed on Saturday when an Israeli gunboat fired on Rafah Beach. His father, Saeed, asked our colleague Bilal Abu Yazan today for a photo of his son when he interviewed them together for our report. I mean, it is just, and there, Mohammed helped our investigation by outlining what he saw when the IDF attacked the convoy of medics. Saeed and Mohammed were on their way to go fishing, a family tradition, before dawn on March 23rd when they were detained by the IDF before the attack. So again, I'm so moved also when I see things of like Palestinians risking their lives to save dogs or cats, like going back into houses to take them out. Or the incredible like solidarity that they have, or seeing them, you know, thanking the students in the United States who are protesting. And then my heart breaks into a million pieces also, and I'm just full of rage and despair at the same time. I do want to shift gears a little bit, though, because something that I haven't been covering as much because we focus so much on Gaza on the show, but is what is happening now with India and Pakistan. And I was going to set it up, but I realized like I would rather, if you don't mind, can you just, because I don't follow this enough to even know if I'm using the right like language in describing the conflict. So walk us through where we are right now and what happened, and then your insights into that.
I mean, look, frankly, a lot of this is lost in the fog of war. So, you know, even what I'm going to say is up for grabs. Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty old conflict that has colonial roots, you know, and I suppose in a way you have to start with that. Remember that India, British India, was partitioned into India and Pakistan at the same time as the partition plan was put forward for Israel and Palestine. I mean, actually, in 1948, the British mandate was supposed to be partitioned into Palestine and Israel, but Israel took the whole thing. That was the Nakba. You know, it's as if India would have just taken the whole thing once the British left, but that didn't happen. Pakistan and India become two states. Immediately, there was a dispute over Kashmir. But really, the dispute is not just over Kashmir. The dispute is about the line drawn between India and Pakistan. Kashmir is the flashpoint of this whole thing. You know, Kashmir is a very complicated issue. We don't have time to get into it. You know, at the time, the Indians and the Pakistanis agreed for a plebiscite to be held of the Kashmiris to decide what they want. Both India and Pakistan actually set aside the plebiscite. There was a war in 1948, right after partition, some months. That war basically has never ended. There have been ceasefires. In 1972, there was a kind of peace agreement, the Simla Agreement, but it wasn't a peace agreement in total. It was basically a standoff agreement. You know, it was prevented a continuation of hostilities. And so there's been a ceasefire for a very long time, since 1948. There was a war in 1948, a war in 1965, a war in 1971, and again a war in 1999, and again this year, 2025, the most recent war. Periodically, both sides have used what is known as strategic depth to harass each other. So in Pakistan, there's a vulnerability because some minority populations in Balochistan and in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa in the north, and recently even in Sindh, minority populations have had some problems with the central government. So the Indian intelligence services poke their nose in there and create issues, even though these are genuine issues of minority rights. Similarly, in Kashmir, there are problems of, you know, not only minority rights, but the Indian army is basically occupying Kashmir. It's a huge density of the Indian forces in Kashmir. And in Kashmir, the Pakistanis have used it as strategic depth to create problems in India. Well, earlier this year, there was a horrendous killing of civilians, tourists at a tourist resort where these gunmen entered, asked people their religion. You see, this is why there's absolutely no comparison between October 7th and what happened in Pahalgam in India. Because October 7th, they didn't go up and try to kill people that they found in, they were trying to take hostages. Okay, so Hamas and the Islamic Jihad were not going there to just create a massacre. These guys come in and they ask people, are you a Hindu, Muslim, Christian, whatever? If you say Hindu, they killed you. Or if you didn't want to say a religion, they killed you. This was grotesque. I mean, nobody should celebrate this kind of, you know, basically religious-oriented violence. And so rather than start an investigation, who did it? What happened? The Indian government immediately said this was done by this group, which is now the new Lashkar-e-Toiba, you know, Jaish-e-Mohammed. They are based in these camps in Pakistan, and they struck the camps, you know, and said, we've only struck the camps. Well, this was going to be a problem because they crossed the border and basically violated you know, the UN charter and attack Pakistani soil. So Pakistan retaliated. Very interesting. During this entire week-long conflict, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th night, really, neither Indian nor Pakistani aircraft crossed the border. Okay? So the aircraft with the manned craft stayed on either side of the border and fired missiles at each other and at targets on the ground. Missiles were fired, surface-to-surface missiles and surface-to-air missiles. There were what are known as loitering munitions. That means various craft like UFOs that basically go and sit and fire. There were drones which move around, and there were drone swarms. So this was an extraordinarily complicated 21st century air war. First time it's happened in world history that this level of complexity where two relatively equal powers are fighting. A 21st century air war, lots of jamming devices. They were using Turkish, Israeli, Chinese, Indian, and Pakistani technology. Very sophisticated display of technology and so on. The biggest gainers in this whole thing were the arms dealers who got to see how their products were working, the various countries that sold these products. In some ways, the Indian and Pakistani government, because they could turn back to their population and say, we defended you, or we, you know, took revenge. But guess who didn't benefit at all? The people of Kashmir. If this was about Kashmir, Kashmir was irrelevant. Kashmir was just irrelevant to this. There will be no justice for the victims in Pahalgam who died. I mean, we don't know who conducted this massacre. Nobody has any clue. Yeah, nobody has a clue why the guards in the facility disappeared. There's been really no investigation. Yeah, the victims of the massacre, 26 of them, no justice for them. Kashmiri is still stuck in limbo. So that's really what happened. This was the very best display of the most sophisticated air war technology that we've seen. Because against the Palestinians, you don't need the most sophisticated. The Palestinians don't have an air force. They don't have really good surface-to-air missiles. Yeah, the United States, in all the wars it's fought, no need for it. In Sudan, the war is not being fought in the air. It's being fought on the ground. Yeah, in Myanmar, the war is being fought on the ground. This is the first highly sophisticated air war. And so all the arms dealers and governments are going to study this for years to come. It's very sad, Katie. It's very... And there was no question of any nuclear trigger. It's almost like both sides agreed, let's test out our equipment.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really, it's so disturbing. And you actually, I heard, I think it was on the People's Dispatch podcast, that you made this interesting point, which is that a lot of people have been comparing Modi to Israel, to Netanyahu, or Modi's tactics to Netanyahu's. And you were saying that actually it's more similar to the American war on terror. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, look, Modi is doing lots of things. Yeah. And, you know, this is not a, I mean, we have a very long history, Mr. Modi and I, that go back decades. In fact, I was one of the people who ran the campaign that got him his visa denied for 10 years into the United States. So, you know, we go back a very long time and we know each other in different ways through a granduncle of mine and so on. We have lots of problems. You know, again, I don't misunderstand anything I'm going to say, you know.
Okay.
I have, you know,
I'm not going to get into any details,
but this is not standing up for him. On the other hand, he has actually not been conducting a genocide in Kashmir. You know, they are not going into Kashmir and just murdering tens of... Let's not minimize what's been happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. It's a completely different scale, you know, to just throw things out there. You know, these are different things. He is definitely oppressing the Muslims of India. He abrogated Article 370, which removes Kashmir's special status. He took away Kashmir's right to be a full-fledged state in India, brought it under central government administration. He tried to pass a law called the Citizenship Amendment Act, which would have basically treated Muslims outside India who seek refugee status in India as second-class citizens and so on. So lots of things he is doing to oppress Muslims, but it's not genocidal. And to compare him to Netanyahu, I think, is a misleading thing. I mean, you may want to compare him to Erdogan, you know, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. I think it's a fair comparison, Mr. Erdogan's position. But on the other hand, Mr. Erdogan is actually not exactly conducting the same kind of oppression of the Kurds as Mr. Modi is doing, because, in fact, Erdogan merely inherited an institutional oppression of the Kurds, which has been there since the 1920s. You know, the violation on speaking Kurdish is not something that Erdogan plays. That's there since Ataturk. So Erdogan is just part of a heritage, you know. So he's not specially oppressing the Kurds. In fact, under his watch, the PKK, the Kurdish People's Party, has just disbanded the military wing, you know, and so on. So
I heard.
I don't think even that's a totally accurate comparison. But there are some accuracies there, much more than with Mr. Netanyahu. And it's also important to say that, yes, it's true, India used Israeli weaponry in this war. And it's true that Indian private companies have continued to sell weaponry to Israel during the genocide. But I have to say, and I'm not defending India again, I don't want this to be misunderstood, just for the sake of facts, Mr. Modi, during this entire genocide, was compelled in a way by India being part of the BRICS not to come out and say, we stand with Israel. Modi didn't fly into Tel Aviv and like Biden and all the Europeans and say, I stand with you. Because he is compelled in a way by the BRICS, because that would be very hard for India to remain in the BRICS. And also, Modi's foreign ministry, at least the permanent staff there, is still has another generation to go of people who are not fully pro-Israel. There's still a generation left, you know, kind of inherited generation. After this generation retires, you're going to have some problems from the Indian foreign ministry. Yes. But hopefully by then the political situation in India might shift. I don't know. I'm not holding my breath. But I want to say that I seek truth from facts, not truth from my prejudices. I very much dislike the Hindu right. I very much dislike Mr. Modi and his government. I've not only been on the record on this, but I've worked against them and so on. So it's not coming, but I still seek truth from facts, not seeking truth from my prejudices.
Right. Yeah. And what else do you think? I mean, are there any media biases that we should look out for on this issue of what's happening with Pakistan and India? Because obviously, you know, we talk so much about Israel and Palestine, and so we're very aware of those, and I focus on those a lot. But what about in this area?
It's a little more difficult to look. I mean, the one funny part, I would say, is the role of Mr. Trump in being the mediator of the whole thing. I mean, that was really funny because, you know, we all know that neither India nor Pakistan are going to directly say to each other, let's cool it. They always seek a third party to come in and do this work for them. Now, what's actually a miscalculation for India was that India has always resisted Pakistan's call for a third party mediation in Kashmir. India has always said that, no, it's a bilateral issue. In fact, India has said it's not an issue, that the whole of Kashmir is part of India, including Pakistan-occupied Kashmir and so on. So the fact that both India and Pakistan seem to have reached out to the Americans to basically give face-saving space for this escalation to end has actually worked badly for India because, in a way, Trump exceeded his mandate. He was just supposed to say, we have organized the de-escalation. Then in typical Trump fashion, he said, and we are going to deal with the problem of Kashmir. And this is a little bit of a problem now for India. Because if Pakistan sits on that tweet or whatever, Truth Social statement, if Pakistan sits on that and says, well, hey, Mr. Trump, this is going to pose a problem because India doesn't want any mediation there. Yeah, because I think there's a sense that Indian sovereignty would then be compromised by asking an outside power. It's like saying that China would like a third-party mediation on Taiwan. That is unacceptable because China says Taiwan is part of China. Why should we have a third party tell us what Taiwan's status should be? You see, so in this sense, there was a miscalculation. I don't know, Katie, exactly if there's biases. I would just say it's really hard to understand this. Because, like, even mine...
There's, like, no APAC. There's not, like, an APAC equivalent, obviously. No. Yeah.
And it's so complicated because Pakistan has been a long-time ally of the United States and, you know, also has now close ties to China. And the United States is part of BRICS with China, but has close relations with the U.S. So everything is really, really in flux. And I would say... this is why sometimes social media is annoying because people want to fix a narrative on something. You know, sometimes history moves really fast. And I think that's why I say seek truth from facts, not from your prejudices. You know, even on the question of Palestine and Israel, I always like to know what are the details of everything. You know, I like to know what the details are rather than just speak truth from prejudice, because, you know, that sometimes can blind you.
Yeah. Well, anything else, BJ, you want to comment on? You've been really generous with your time. Anything you want to say about China, Russia, Ukraine, BRICS?
No, the only thing I want to say is that, look, you guys are doing a great job. I know it's really difficult with all the kinds of pressures in the United States for reporters, for people who want to even breathe. You know, you told a story about going to have brunch, I suppose, with your mother and her friends, and even that was a little uncomfortable. Yeah. I mean, I just want to say, you know, just make sure that every once in a while you read a nice novel, take yourself out of your head. Your own mental health is very important to me, Katie. You're too young to burn out. Make sure Bradley over there also takes care of himself. Because, you know, you guys need to be long distance runners. We are not sprinters. We don't have to fight every fight for everybody. Yeah. We are here for the long term. I'm 58 years old. I want to be here for at least 20 more years having a kind of conversation like this. Not interested in burning out, and I don't want you to burn out either. Okay.
Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and my upcoming documentary and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.